this past week, I received some very disturbing and sad news. And it was not that my father had passed away. That certainly was sad, and yet I'm grateful that he went peacefully in his sleep, and he's probably better off. I worry more about my mother adjusting to life without him, certainly. But there's something that's far worse than physical death, and that's spiritual death. And this past week, I learned that a former student over at the college is now a catechumen in the Greek Orthodox Church. He's going to become a Greek Orthodox priest. And when asked about, well, what made you make this change? Why did he lose his faith? And the answer that he gave was he just found it impossible to imagine to resolve this great conflict that he saw, that the Restoration Movement, which emerged in the 1800s, had all the right answers, and that for 1700 years in between, that nobody had the truth, that there's this gap in which if the Restoration Movement is correct, if it represents true Christianity, then where was it all of these, thousands of years? Why do you answer a question like that, or an approach to the Bible like that? Well, I would suggest that it is what I would call the spirit of Babylon. That's what I want to speak about and study with you tonight for a few minutes. Since we have the business meeting following, I'm going to try to cut this a little short. And in that, we may abbreviate some of these things, but at least want you to be thinking about this, and as you continue to study through the Bible, to see whether this makes sense and ties everything together. In Revelation chapter 17, we'll begin. And the first question I would like to ask is, who is this Babylon in the book of Revelation? Or who is this Babylon even in the New Testament? And why is this person described as Babylon? Well, of course, this is one of the great controversies in studying the book of Revelation. Some say it represents the Roman Empire. Others say that it represents the city of Jerusalem. Beginning in Revelation chapter 17, verse 1, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sets on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations of the unclean things of her immorality. And upon her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. And the angel said to me, why do you wonder? I shall tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and to go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast, that he was and is not and will come. Well, we don't have time, of course, to explore in great detail how the book of Revelation is using this figurative language. John has told us about some beasts earlier in the book. And these clearly are based upon the beasts that Daniel had a vision of, particularly in Daniel chapter 7 of his book in the Old Testament. And based on this symbolism, there is this beast that is described with this woman, this mother of all prostitutes, riding upon it. And it clearly represents some great world power that is evil and engages in a spiritual prostitution and leads people astray. And coming down to chapter 18, the first three verses, after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. This is just an angel that has enough brilliance to outshine the sun and to provide illumination to the earth. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And she has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." I think the key to understanding who this particular individual is in chapter 17 and 18. There are numerous Old Testament quotations that John uses in these two chapters. And with one exception, they all are traced back to Old Testament prophecies against Assyria, Babylon, and Tyre and Sidon. Which is really remarkable when you think about it, because John is using this image of a prostitute, of a spiritual adulteress. And the Old Testament is filled with prophetic language that speaks about the spiritual infidelity of Israel to God. You will remember that frequently in the Old Testament, the prophets describe the relationship of God to His people as that of husband and wife. And His wife has been unfaithful to Him, and she's been out committing spiritual adultery and even prostitution with all of the other gods of the other nations. And yet, John does not use those many, many, many passages that describe Israel's spiritual adultery, but rather a handful of passages that talk about the spiritual adultery of foreign nations, such as Assyria and Babylon, Tyre and Sidon. And that suggests to me quite strongly that the nation we're talking about here in chapter 17 and 18 is not Israel, not Jerusalem, but indeed is the Roman Empire. Now, we could further study that at some other point. But I also believe that that is consistent with the two other references to Babylon that we find in the New Testament. Now, Jesse, in his class in Peter, has pointed out in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 13 this mysterious reference that Peter makes to "she who is in Babylon greets you," which appears to be a congregation spoken of as a woman, "she who is in Babylon," and located here in the place Babylon. Well, is this literal Babylon, the city of Mesopotamia that is famous from the Old Testament? Is it a small little town down in Egypt that was also named Babylon? And there were a handful of other little towns by that name as well. Or does it refer to the city of Rome? And, of course, tradition places Peter in Rome. Many times, brethren want to get away from that because we don't want Peter in Rome. We don't want to lend any comfort to the idea that he may have been the first pope and that kind of thing. And sometimes I think we overreact to certain things and go to the other extreme. I have no problem if Peter was in Rome or crucified in Rome. First Clement is one of those early so-called Christian writings that we have, and he's writing in that very town, not 30 years later, and he claims that the very spot where Peter has been crucified can be identified, and there's a marker there that shows where both Paul and Peter had been crucified. Well, that probably was a very reliable tradition. You think back to how many people in this town would know firsthand what happened 30 years ago. And so it very likely is the case, and very likely it was Rome from which Peter was writing. But the one that is abundantly clear is back in Acts chapter 7, and this, in fact, is the earliest reference of the use of the term Babylon to refer to Rome. And you may remember Stephen's speech in Acts chapter 7. He's gotten in trouble. His teaching has been misrepresented as an attack against the temple and the law of Moses and so on, in much the same way that people twisted Jesus' words around. But there must have been some kernel of truth to that, that they perceived in the teaching of Stephen that the old covenant was passing away and the physical temple, there would be no further use for that. And Stephen's response in his speech in Acts chapter 7 is pretty much that the Jews had transformed the temple into an idol. The Old Testament speaks several times about worshiping that which is made with hands. And the temple, it was made with hands. And it actually had become an idol that the people worshiped rather than God. And so when God Himself came among them, they rejected Him because of their preconceived notions. But because of this, God will bring judgment against these people. You have rejected the Christ. There is a judgment that is coming against you. And in AD 70, the Roman army came and destroyed the city of Jerusalem and the temple. And the New Testament claims very explicitly that that is a direct consequence of their rejection of Jesus as the Messiah. And so we know that God is raising up Rome as an instrument of judgment here in the time of the first century, just as he did some centuries before when the first temple was destroyed. And in one of the great coincidences of history, the first temple of Solomon and the second temple that had replaced it were both destroyed on the same day of the year. I don't think that was a coincidence. And in this oracle of judgment that Stephen speaks, he quotes from Amos chapter 5, verses 26 and 27. And he says in verse 42 and 43, God turned away and delivered them up to serve the host of heaven. And as is written in the book of the prophets, it was not for me that you offered victims and sacrifices 40 years in the wilderness, was it, O house of Israel? You also took along the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of the god Rumpha, the images which you made to worship them. I also will remove you beyond Babylon. Now, the basic point of Stephen's speech is that these Jews of his day were acting just like their fathers did. And what did their fathers do? Their fathers rejected God. Moses was sent among them as a lawgiver and a judge. And they said, who made you judge over us? Who put you in charge? And of course, that's the very same thing Stephen's audience had said to Jesus. Who made you the Christ, in other words? And there was this expectation that a prophet like Moses would come. Deuteronomy chapter 18 foretold as much. And the people in their imagination thought, boy, when this one like Moses comes, he'll glow like Moses did, and he'll kind of levitate in the air, and we'll all recognize him and bow down before him and say, oh, we are living in the great age of second Moses. But Stephen takes them back and reminds them, how did the fathers treat Moses? They rejected his law, they insulted him, they mistreated him. And so the second Moses you need to be looking for is a person who's been insulted and mistreated, indeed the one that you crucified, that is Jesus the Christ. And what was the consequence for those people of the previous generation when they rejected the Lord, when they went into their idolatry and did not follow the law of Moses? Ultimately, the worst consequence, the worst curse that the law pronounced upon God's people was to be carried away into foreign captivity. And the Babylonians came actually three times, 605, 597, and the last time in 586 B.C., and burned the temple to the ground and destroyed the city of Jerusalem, carried the people away, deported them into captivity. And Amos predicts this. He's talking particularly about the northern kingdom being carried away by the Assyrians, actually. But this is the judgment that comes against God's people for not being faithful. And Stephen's point is very simple. The same thing will happen today. You have been unfaithful. You have rejected God. You have committed your own form of idolatry. What do you think is going to happen? God will judge you. And he quotes this passage from Amos and applies it to them and says, God will carry you away beyond Babylon. The problem is, the text in Amos doesn't say that. Stephen has misquoted what Amos said. Now, how do you explain that? Well, there are several possibilities. First of all, Stephen didn't understand what Amos said. He was ignorant of his Bible. Not a very attractive option to me. Secondly, Stephen could have thought, I'm preaching to a bunch of dummies here. They don't know that I'm changing the Bible. I'll just change the wording as I please and they'll never notice. Again, not a very attractive option. He's talking to the Sanhedrin. He's talking to the learned members of society. They would have recognized instantly he has changed the wording of the passage. It'd be just as if I stood up here and said, Satan created the heavens and the earth. You would know immediately I'm making allusion to Genesis 1:1. But you would also know instantly, I changed the wording. And you'd either say, well, you know, Tom's off his noodle there, or he's trying to make some silly point. Well, what's the point that Stephen is making? Well, the location that Amos had specified was Damascus, that the northern kingdom of Israel would be carried away beyond Damascus. But Stephen changes it and says, you'll be removed beyond Babylon. Because Babylon has become this designation of Rome. And it's a hint that Rome itself would be the instrument that would come and destroy the city and destroy the temple as a consequence for their rebellion against God. And so this great world power described as Babylon, and fittingly applied to the great world power of the first century, which is Rome. Now, if you'll turn to Daniel chapter 2, we also have Babylon appearing here. And you're probably familiar with Nebuchadnezzar's vision that he had. And the king puts a difficult prospect before his interpreters, not only to interpret the dream, but to tell him the dream to begin with and provide the interpretation. And, of course, Daniel is able to do this because God gives him that gift. And he describes in verses 31 through 35 the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. He sees a great image, and the head is made out of gold, and the chest of silver, and the groin area out of brass, and the legs of iron, and finally the feet out of iron mixed with clay. And when I was a kid, I tended to think of that as like Play-Doh or something. It's probably ceramic, you know, hardened clay. It's been baked, but even more brittle and difficult to stand on. And what is the interpretation of this? Well, notice in verse 36, this was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. And then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. And we might pause and note, historically, what happens in fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy is the Babylonian Empire will barely outlive Nebuchadnezzar himself. It quickly falls into decline, and the Medes and the Persians emerge as the world power. And they will prevail for a couple of centuries, and then Alexander the Great will come along, and the Greeks will rule over the world as a great world empire. And even after the death of Alexander, the smaller parts of the Greek empire continue. And then finally a fourth empire, which will turn out to be the Roman, will prevail. And these are the four great world powers that are described here. Now, notice what happens to this image. In verse 44, in the days of those kings, that is that fourth great world empire, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Now, of course, what Nebuchadnezzar had seen in his dream was a little rock that grows into a mighty mountain and smashes this image and pulverizes it. And he describes that in verse 45, inasmuch as you saw a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future, so the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. Well, we could explore this in greater detail as well, but basically what Daniel is talking about is that in the days of that fourth great world empire, Rome, God's kingdom would be established. Basically, he's talking about the church. A spiritual kingdom, one that cannot be defeated, one that cannot be imprisoned, one that cannot be put to death. It is the true world power in this world, although it will never be recognized as such by people who think like this world does. Because what they think of as powerful are things you can see. Big armies, large bank accounts, those things that really count for something in this life, in this world, those are truly world powers. But you'll notice in the vision that Nebuchadnezzar has, the image is destroyed all at once. Why does the vision show the image being destroyed all at once? You know, we would tend to think of this as a historical sequence. You know, the gold head falls off, Babylonians are gone. And now the Persians are in charge. And then when the Persian Empire falls, the chest of silver falls off. And now you're left with the midsection of bronze here, and the Greeks are in charge. And when their empire falls, then you're left with the legs of iron with the Roman Empire. But that's not how the vision is. And that symbolizes that it really doesn't matter the name that is attached to this image. It's like a restaurant. You know, you can change the sign out front and say under new management, but it may very well be the same restaurant. It's the same image. It's the same spirit of Babylon. And at one moment, it may be truly the Babylonian Empire, and it may be followed by a Persian Empire, and a Greek Empire, and a Roman Empire. But for all practical purposes, it is the same empire. In all of its particulars, all of the ways in which it is important, it's the same empire. And there are really only two forces in this world. There is that of God, and there's that of this evil, sinful world. And it is personified in things like the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman empires. But this kingdom that will arise will smash them all. It will smash the spirit of Babylon and destroy it. It doesn't matter what the name is. It doesn't matter what the label is. And even in our own day, this power may manifest itself in some way. But we have the confidence that the kingdom of God will prevail over any kingdom, any power of this world. And finally, if we turn back to Isaiah chapter 13 and 14, we have Babylon that appears here. And the question we have to ask ourselves is why Isaiah begins his oracles against the nations with Babylon. The great world superpower of Isaiah's day was Assyria. And for Isaiah to begin a series of oracles against the nations with Babylon doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It would be like if a prophet arose today and said, "You really need to watch out for those East Timorians." And most of us would say, "Who? Where's East Timor? Some country somewhere in the world?" Now, Babylon probably wasn't that insignificant, but they were not the great power in the world. They would not be the ones you would describe in the terms that Isaiah does. And so why does he begin with that? Well, it is true that Babylon will come to fulfill this role that Isaiah describes. But I dare say it is because what is at root in all of these nations that Isaiah preaches to is the same spirit of Babylon again. And so notice Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1, the oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. Come down to verse 6, "Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. And therefore all hands will fall limp, every man's heart will melt. They will be terrified, pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor, they will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, the moon will not shed its light. And thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind scarcer than the gold of Ophir. And therefore I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place, and the fury of the Lord of hosts, and the day of his burning anger," and so on. Well, this is prophetic language of judgment that God brings against, in this case, the nation of Babylon. And it was literally fulfilled in that the day of the Lord came against the Babylonians. Now, it wasn't literally fulfilled in that, you know, the lights of heaven went out and all of that. That's symbolic language of the fall of the nation. But if you come over to chapter 14, Isaiah continues this oracle against Babylon. And you'll recognize some of this language, surely. He's basically saying Babylon's going to be taken down to the grave, to die. "Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you. Worms are your covering. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of morning, son of the dawn," Lucifer is where we get that expression. "You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. You said in your heart, 'I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High.'" And so here is this great braggart who says, I will be like God. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder at you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? And notice again in verse 22, he's still talking about Babylon. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares the Lord. Well, a lot of people mistakenly read Isaiah chapter 14 as a description of Satan. He's fallen from heaven. He tried to make himself equal to God and so on. But it is clearly an oracle against Babylon, that this pride of humanity that exalted itself against God comes under the judgment of God and he is cast down. And the Babylonian Empire received such a judgment from God. But the real importance of this isn't that there was a literal Babylonian Empire that was one day judged by God, but really that we've had this problem of Babylon ever since the beginning. And it really goes back to Genesis chapter 11, where we read about the Tower of, unfortunately, Babel. And why in the world the translators decided to translate the Tower of Babel instead of Babylon is utterly beyond me. It is exactly the same place. It is exactly the same word in the text. And to that extent, we translate it Babel in one place and Babylon in another place. People miss the connection. What was the problem in Genesis chapter 11? Well, it was precisely this problem. We will combine our human resources, our powers, and we will rival God. And if we do this, nobody, God Himself, cannot stop us. And that was that spirit of Babylon that arose in the very beginning of the Bible. And we see it all the way even to the very end of the book of Revelation. And that describes one of the great problems that mankind has, the spirit of Babylon, where we think of human power, human ingenuity, human resources, and so on, and think somehow this is comparable to God, that we can go toe-to-toe with God. And it cannot be done. So how does the spirit of Babylon manifest itself today? How does it tie in with the young man's problem who decided he had some great theological problem? Well, it manifests itself in this tendency that we have to want to see things. We want to build great things. People are not content simply to be New Testament Christians. I read my Bible, I see what God says I ought to do, and I quietly go about doing that. That's not good enough. Even in religion, we need the spirit of Babylon at work. We've got to build some big cathedral. We've got to fill it with large numbers of people. We have to have a large bank account. We have to summon monies from all the four corners of the earth to pool together for some great operation for God. God does not need our towers of Babylon. The gospel can be preached simply by Christians being faithful to the Lord. Every congregation of God's people is completely capable of doing everything that God wants it to do. Every congregation of God's people can be self-sufficient, self-supporting. We normally think of that in some financial sense, but it's a spiritual question. Are we capable of doing what God expects of us? Yes. Can we conduct some great world campaign to reach every person with the gospel of Christ? No. But God doesn't need that. He didn't have that in the first century. And the gospel spread so rapidly. How did it work? What special program did the early church use? What was the Jerusalem outreach mechanism? There wasn't one. Other than Christians, as they went about, simply told the good news to those that they met. And if we're content with that, we can simply be New Testament Christians. But as long as we have this nagging sense that we have to build some great tower to God, this spirit of Babylon will continue to plague us. And so, what was that young man looking for? He's looking for something you could see. Some denomination, some church structure that you could look at. And he traced through time and look at it and say, oh, look there in 1546. There is a New Testament church here. Or in 732 A.D., here in this location, there's a New Testament church. Only God knows those who were faithful over those years. Only God knows today who is faithful. I don't care how many churches you find that have a sign out front that says they're a church that belongs to Jesus Christ, that would make it so. And we may write letters and say, oh, this is the only church in Podunk, Illinois. Well, how do you know that? Maybe somebody picked up their Bible and read it and simply set about doing what it said. And you don't know they exist because they're not in some list somewhere. They're not on the internet somewhere. We need to truly believe in the power of the gospel, that it is the seed, it is the power of God into salvation, and as simple people read it and abide by it, they can be New Testament Christians. No towers of Babylon needed. God does not need our great work projects. God does not need our great amalgamated effort to pool together. We need to simply trust in His way and to do things that please Him. Who do these towers of Babylon honor? Not God. Even if they're religious in nature, even if we set about to build up some big church, it is a monument to the work of men, not God. And New Testament congregations simply need to be people who are trying to serve the Lord. That doesn't mean it's a sin to be a large congregation. The sin is wanting to be a large congregation for the glory and vanity of man. The sin is thinking that that's the only way you can do what the Lord wants you to do. No, the main thing is do what the Lord says and let the chips fall where they may. And to be content simply to be New Testament Christians. What does God want me to do? What is pleasing to Him and what is not pleasing to Him? And so, too often, we just do things our way, but we put a paint job on it and say it's religious. We claim that this is God's way of doing things, but it's not. It's the same spirit of Babylon at work that always has been. They take your songbook and turn to the song that Barry has selected. And the very point of this song is to allow God to have His way with us. And that's really the point of the lesson. We want to do things God's way. And God's way is not the way of Babylon. It is not the way of big things. Bigger is better. Bigger is essential. Bigger is crucial. You know, if God doesn't have big, it just can't get done. Well, God's big enough. And if just us, just me, myself, and God, that's enough. We can be faithful to the Lord and simply do what God would have us to do. The only question is, are we doing what God would have us to do? And that means studying the Bible, seeing what God says, what God wants, and trying our best to be faithful to that. And so truly, let's make sure that God has His way with us. And we make our way His way by submitting our will utterly and completely to His. If there's some way we can help you, even in doing that tonight in your own life, let that be known while we stand, while we sing the song of encouragement.